I'm making a radio programme about physical text, and I thought I'd start with handwriting. Here's a sample of my inelegant hand.
I may be one of the first of my generation who types more quickly than they write. W. H. Auden wrote that we should write with pen or pencil, not typewriter. We like our own handwriting. It's like smelling our own farts. Very Auden. Sending huge love, Stephen. XX.
Well, there you are, Grayson. That was my letter to you with that W.H. Auden quote from The Dyer's Hand, I think it was, about handwriting being part of one's personality. What do you make of my handwriting? Can you detect any of my personality in it?
It's quite sort of friendly handwriting. Yes, I think that's what I like about it. It's quite round and even. And very intelligible. It's very legible. So that's a plus.
I can see my father's in it. Does your handwriting, we're going to come to that later, yours, but does it have family traits? Can you see
I don't
your
know, because I didn't have my father around as a child, and he has very distinctive, very sort of almost like a seismograph, his handwriting. It's very sloping and very up and down, and mine is almost the opposite. Mine's very loopy. My mother had handwriting not entirely dissimilar from yours, actually.
These days, especially as handwriting becomes a more rarefied kind of phenomenon, one can know someone for a long time through texts and other things and emails without ever knowing their handwriting. And when you finally see it, you can be brought up short.
I should think most of my friends, I don't know any of their handwriting. I mean, curiously, you know, when I get a card or a letter, there's certain friends instantly, before I even read their signature at the bottom, I know it's from them because they have such distinctive style.
But I'm not sure Auden's right in saying we like our own handwriting or our own farts, but let that be. It's almost as if we're self-conscious.
I grip the pen with a physicality that's almost embarrassing.
My handwriting is a bit messy, really. I'm also left-handed, which I'm using as an excuse.
It struck me as very odd. I mean, we don't say about other things that are personal to us, oh, I'm so ashamed of my shoes, I'm so ashamed of my clothes. But handwriting really does seem like something that tells everybody about us.
In reverse order there, you heard the writer Philip Hensher, a chronicler of handwriting, Dr. Kate de Ryker, an expert on 16th century print, and the lady pen gripper was Professor Mary Beard, who'll be bringing some Roman writing for examination. Everyone you'll hear is in very different ways expert in our subject, the physicality of written, inscribed and printed language, official and unofficial, formal and informal, past and present. All this at a time of anxiety because so much of what we read and write nowadays never goes near ink, pen or paper. So, the very stuff of language and what it says about us, including this kind of writing.
Drugs dealer lists, we see witness statements, we see things that aren't written necessarily on pieces of paper, so things written on plastic, names in hats that people want to look at. There is tale of one of my colleagues from a long time back seeing handwriting on a body part.
That's a forensic document examiner, and her job is to examine physical text as potential legal evidence. Mary Beard does much the same thing in the service of Roman history, usually formal inscriptions, but here she is analysing graffiti in a Pompeian brothel.
Even here, people are memorialising their other seedy sexual encounters by writing it on the wall. Futui bene hic. Nobody knows to know any Latin at all to know that what futui means. You know, it's saying, oh, I had a very good time here in rather cruder language than that. We don't imagine that the Pompeian rich were going to the brothel. If they wanted spare sex, the rich used slaves. You know, the brothel was probably frequented by very much passing trade, sailors and the ordinary guys around town.
The observation that the ordinary guys round town, as opposed to the educated ruling classes, could and did read and write is a valuable one, even if it is in the lowly form of that sexual TripAdvisor rating. Their smutty scrawl helps us assess how much literacy there was in 79 AD Rome, more than might be expected, judging by that and other casual graffiti.
One of the funniest bits of scrawl on a wall is one that says, I can't understand how you can still stand up. You've got so much writing on you.
But is the writing on the wall for the writing on the wall in the new age of virtual text? Or is that just the familiar anxiety we feel when something big and new happens to the way we communicate? The very invention of writing might well have invoked anxiety too. It's very difficult to imagine a world in which writing didn't exist, but Plato did imagine just that in 370 BC. In his work Phaedrus, he imagines an even more ancient Egyptian king being introduced to this new technology.
O king, here is something that once learned will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memory. I have discovered a potion for memory and for wisdom.
But the king worries that this new technology, this writing, rather than enhancing memory, might actually damage it. Instead of making the effort to remember and digest what has been told to them, he worries that people might delegate the process of memory to this new potion. They might externalize the process of understanding to this fancy storage system called writing. Does that remind you of anything? Philip Hensher has written a book called The Missing Ink about handwriting.
I was just suddenly concerned about the way that handwriting seemed to be disappearing from our lives, really. And it had been a very important part of what you knew about another human being. So I wondered whether we were letting something go without properly wondering about it. There is this science or pseudoscience called graphology that starts to arise in the 1880s, and people start publishing books explaining that if you do this particular thing with your capital A, it means that you're good with money or so on. It's obviously absurdly over-specific. It actually comes up in Sherlock Holmes from time to time, and there's a moment in The Sign of Four when Holmes is looking at a letter and says to Watson,
"Have you ever had occasion to study character and handwriting? What do you make of this fellow's scribble?" "It is legible and regular," I answered. "A man of business habits and some force of character." Holmes shook his head. "Look at his long letters," he said. "They hardly rise above the common herd. That D might be an A, and that L an E. Men of character always differentiate their long letters, however illegibly they may write. There is vacillation in his K's and self-esteem in his capitals."
Whether there's any truth in it, I really don't know. Sherlock Holmes, I would think, is much too sensible a man to put any faith in these unproved assertions. On the other hand, I think we would all agree that you do know something about people from their handwriting, maybe something quite kind of broad. It's almost impossible for me to say what my handwriting is like. Graphologists would say that there's all sorts of things in it, one of which is that I'm quite kind of decisive and impatient. Another one, that I'm very bad at keeping secrets. And graphologists would say that you can deduce that from my handwriting because I don't close my final G's. If you make a final loop around the circle at the top of a G, that's supposed to mean that you're very good at keeping secrets. I once had a look at the Queen's handwriting and she closes it like anything. She's very good at keeping secrets.
You wouldn't want a graphologist using the way you loop your G's or scribble your W's to give character witness evidence about you in a court of law. But such is the individuality of our handwriting that it can be analysed by professional scientific practitioners.
My name's Kate Barr and I've been a forensic document examiner for nearly 25 years. And I work at Key Forensic Services, which is one of the largest UK forensic providers. So we have DNA lab, chemistry labs, toxicology labs, digital firearms. And forensic documentation is a full part of all the other forensic examinations.
Scientists in Kate's field investigate a wide range of crimes.
Recently, in the news, there's been a nurse who was forging doctor's signatures to get Botox. We've had people who've been accused of harassment and sexual crimes who are writing to their victims. And I've given evidence at the International Criminal Court at The Hague into the massacre at Srebrenica. So any handwriting involved in a crime.
And Kate's focus is what the document tells her about the process of how it was written.
how the pen has moved across the paper to form the characters, in essence. So if you think of a capital E, you could do an L shape with two crossbars, but the order you do your crossbar, you could do the top one first, you could do the middle one first. You could do a Greek E, you could do a more rounded E.
Kate usually scrutinises a sample document and a questioned document to try and match writing to writer. But can anything be reliably revealed about the writer in one sample of writing alone? Old or young? Their sex?
Not their sex. You can get an indication, but it's no more than that, and it wouldn't be statistically accurate. Possibly you could tell the age, or a broad age range. You could probably tell a younger person from an older person. Nationality, to a certain extent, you may be able to get an indication of where somebody learnt to write.
But what of Sherlock's observations?
There's no scientific evidence that handwriting can tell a person's personality.
Which is a pity, really, because the individuality of, I don't know, Hitler's or Hillary Clinton's or Grayson Perry's here. I'm really looking forward to seeing your handwriting, Grayson, because I've seen it on the maps you do, and where it's exquisite. And so I'm looking forward to a very beautiful letter from you.
Yes, I think you'll be disappointed because on the maps, that's my what I call my sort of pseudo-archaic writing that is trying to keep into the idea that the maps are somehow historic without actually being kind of tied to a particular period, but they look vaguely olden days.
Because writing is a form of drawing. You're drawing letters.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think my drawing style is very related to how I write as well. I mean, I think the rhythm and the kind of tone of it is very similar. I think the kind of way that I allow myself to make mistakes. I think if an artist's style is their own personalised series of mistakes, really. And
yes,
I think the same could be said of writing. It's how it deviates from a kind of classic-looking text.
So far, we've been talking about single physical specimens of writing. But nowadays, when we say writing, we're often referring to something more vague. For example, we know little of the writing of Cicero, the great Roman orator.
We use a shorthand. Cicero's speeches still survive. That quite often makes people think that somehow the copy that Cicero wrote out in 63 BC has miraculously survived. It is, I'm afraid, nothing like that. What we mean is that Cicero, let's say, delivered his speech in the Roman Senate. He probably had some notes. And if he was pleased with it, he would go home and he'd get his slave to copy it out into a very nice version. And then people would say, oh, I think it'd be rather nice to have a version of Cicero's speeches. So more and more slaves would be there copying. But it's been the work of centuries of examining different manuscript copies, really to try to get back to the very, very original things that Cicero said. And if everything relies on, you know, presumably battalions of poor old slaves, all the way through, there's the possibility of what classicists call corruption.
Which means that that naughty graffiti is, or perhaps I should say are, more authentic than some of our great classical works. In the grand scheme of things, nothing much changes in the world of physical text until...
Do you want me to put on ink?
Yes, please.
I'll do that. But before, I would like to put on an apron, because otherwise I'll smudge myself. Just a moment.
We've come to Antwerp to look at the next logical step in the development of physical text. And it can be a messy business, hence the apron. We're arriving in Belgium, Flanders really, at a time some 1650 years after Cicero wrote his best material, at the end of the 16th century. Ah, he's back.
My name is Guy Hutsebout. I'm responsible for the typographical collection of the museum, and I'm the printer of the Plantin Moretus Museum. My apron says, labore et constantia, true labour and consistency.
Apt motto. the hard physical labour of the print room and the miraculous consistency of its inky output at the end of the 16th century.
This is good ink.
And the thing about the ink was the stink. Burnt linseed oil was the key ingredient, and the burning had to take place outside the city walls.
Now, cities smelled awful in the 16th century, but the thing that they did this outside the city walls must have meant that it was even more horrible than the normal smells. The oil had to be thickened. If you heat up oil, at a certain point, it will self-inflame. And after three or four times, the thickness of the oil is correct. When you stick in your dagger and you pull it out, and there's a whole thread of oil coming with. These are leather tampons.
The tampons, they look like pairs of boxing gloves with handles, are very important tools used to spread ink evenly onto composed type. Now, my dog has no paws. In fact, no dog has paws. They pant rather than sweat. And a master printer and businessman called Christophe Plantin noticed this and used dogskin tampons that, unlike the usual pigskin, didn't allow ink through the surface to ruin the horsehair filling. It's a detail, but a very important one.
The biggest cost in the whole printing office of Plantin was not buying new presses, was not making new type, was not the paper, but was the skin, the leather for the tampons.
Christophe Plantin invented nothing. He simply upscaled and perfected what we might call the Gutenberg principle, established a century earlier. Why run a print shop with one press when you can have a dozen or more on the go? At Museum Plantin Moretus, you can see real presses from the period at work and imagine the physical scale of the operation.
This is really one of the very first industrial firms that existed. Yeah? It is a production line of specialists producing, finally, a complete book. All kinds of humanistic works were printed here. We have atlases, we have science, art books. One press could print in one day 1,000 to 1,250 printed sheets of paper printed on both sides. At a certain point, must have been 1575, Plantin had about 16 presses working for him, 32 printers working, and 20 typesetters.
So, a mix of content, Bibles and non-religious works, including ancient classical texts. And at the centre of it all, 16 sweaty men pressing inky type to paper again and again in huge print runs in multiple languages bound for different European cities in this Pongy predecessor of Silicon Valley. By the way, a Mr. Garamond made type for Plantin, the same Garamond font that you doubtless have on your computer. But what about those we now regard as the great English writers of the time? Shakespeare, Marlowe, Johnson. Well, they've been busy reading the classical texts brought to them by the wonders of printing. And some of those stories have been finding their way onto the stage. But at the end of the 16th century, they haven't achieved worldwide fame.
They are creating something with the inspiration of having read all of these great classical texts, which they can then put into something for the people, so popular culture, whether that's printed or on the stage.
This is Kate DeRuyter of Newcastle University on the writers we now know as the great dramatist pioneers.
Although they would have been famous to each other, they would have never have thought that they would have had such an international reach, because English was not a global language and England was a backwater of Europe.
The true life drama of the late 16th century was in the European media. At a time of heightened political and religious sensitivities, the great printers went back and forth across European borders, spreading their new technology and the new ideas it enabled, and worrying the powers that be. And there's a technical reason why the world of ideas was growing. Between the big Bibles and classics, big printers were finding runs of small print jobs economic. Chi Hutzebaut.
Often just one-page prints were made, like pamphlets, like announcements printed for the city of Antwerp, where they announced new rules, new regulations, those things.
Ordinances, ballads, almanacs, for example, and things like playbills, which are adverts in some ways that people would have seen around them in the streets. In reality, it's the publishers who are the ones who are the innovators at this time, because they would be taking the punt on a writer.
And the new industrialization of physical text was changing the role of writer, so long dependent on wealthy patrons.
They're starting to see the public as another way of making money, so they're starting to get their writing published. And that's where cheap print comes in. It's mainly young men, and they were meant to be doing traditional jobs like preparing to go into the church or to become lawyers. But there's a sort of a glut of overly educated young men. And in some ways, that's where you have this is why you have this boom in entertainment, in the theatres, but publishing as well. We think of this time as merry old England, but actually it's a really fractious time to be living in. Debates were happening on stage, but they're also happening in these, what we call cheap print. If we need to think about these writers at this time, the closest analogy is thinking of them as satirical columnists.
The establishment of the time had every right to fear these new writers, but the writers had fears as well. One, Thomas Nash, wrote a racy, picaresque novel called The Unfortunate Traveller. Nash craved the fame that print might bring, but was anxious that this medium would make his work ephemeral, again, for a very physical reason. Back then, the idea of something being not worth the paper it was written on was literally applicable. Paper was costly, so the paper in books was worth recycling. Kate de Ryker is part of a Newcastle University team researching Thomas Nash in great detail. She says he worried that his books would meet a prosaic end.
He talks about how, hope that this entertains you, but then you can use this text to wrap up meat. You can use it to pad out your shoes if they're leaking. And in reality, what probably happens is that printers buy or get back lots of the paper and they recycle it.
Bit like pulp fiction.
Yeah, exactly, like pulp fiction. And these are things which don't have a great survival rate, but sometimes you find them in the bindings of other books because printers would have used it to, say, strengthen the spine or to strengthen the covers of books.
Again, stuff has a big part to play in what survives and what doesn't. Had paper been cheaper, we would have known a whole lot more about the 16th century. Kate has also found an intriguing piece of detail about people's fascination with this newly available medium of print.
There are some books where we can see marginalia, so people's handwriting in the side, where they're practising their writing to look more like the print.
Ah, because print had authority. Print ruled. But in the hands of the rebellious or the careless, it could be dangerous. Print put a perilous distance between what was meant by the writer and what emerged from the press. In 1630, an edition of the Bible was published with a sinful typographical error.
Thou shalt commit adultery.
But let's remember those readers trying obediently to improve their handwriting by carefully copying print in the margin of books. A neat way to bring us back to handwriting again, and to bring us back to neat handwriting again. In the 19th century, the ability to write neatly, consistently, swiftly, accurately, to be a kind of human text machine, was the key to personal success. The need for mass literacy grew fast on both sides of the Atlantic. Legions of clerks, a bit like Mary Beard's literate Roman slaves, were employed simply for their copperplate capacity. Handwriting gurus appeared, like Platt R. Spencer. The Ford and Coca-Cola logos are inspired by his method.
The slant. This is at an angle of 52 degrees. Long experience and observation have proven that this slant is the best adapted to rapid and elegant penmanship.
But the reformer who probably shaped yours and mine was a pleasant-sounding woman called Marion Richardson in the 1920s. Her method lasted well into the 70s and perhaps beyond.
Learning to write should be a happy experience. it is necessary to distinguish between the different ways in which a child uses handwriting, remembering that a free, live quality of line is always to be valued above mere neatness.
Bringing us back to the idea of individuality, self-expression, art even, and Grayson's reply to my letter. Dear Stephen, when I was an art student, I can remember making my handwriting deliberately more chaotic, to the point of
it becoming illegible. I have honed it down since. I think I thought my schoolboy hand was too crabbed and polite. Love, Grayson.
Well, now, Grayson, that's your handwriting is a surprise. It's actually, it's quite attractive. Your T's are a great big loop. They're like an E, actually, but it's obviously a T because of the size is different to the size of the E's. You've kept the lines pretty well.
I've sort of centred it quite nicely,
yes,
haven't
exactly.
I, on the page.
Yeah.
I'm almost wondering, actually, now you've said that, whether I subconsciously composed visually while I'm writing, and I'll put extra loop on something to balance out the loop that's against it somehow compositionally, because that's certainly how I draw.
Although I have to say Grayson looks like crayon, which is quite pleasing. <talking drawing. laughs> Grayson, thank you so much for talking and writing to me. Let's not leave with the impression that physical text, ink, pen, press, type is dying, or that we need to be in a panic about what replaces it. Here are wise words from missing ink man Philip Hensher and historian and writer Mary Beard.
I think we're in the middle of a huge experiment with human consciousness. What does it do to the brain not to grow up writing with pen on paper, not to grow up reading a book within hard covers?
One thing I would never be able to explain to you is how, when I was on my laptop and I pressed the letter M, let's say, or Q, and I saw the M or the Q come on the screen, I wouldn't know how that happened. I would have known that in an old-fashioned typewriter.
It's a process that we're in the middle of, really, and we won't really know what the results of the experiment are until it's all completely over.
But more than anything, the production of script on object using hand and implement is a way of looking and seeing and understanding and actually feeling how you make words.